Just going to start by reading you something. I think you could talk about it first as a strong empathy for the work I am engaging with. This seems another aspect of my general character. I've always had considerable powers of absorption, and when I'm absorbed, I suspend my critical faculties. I've noticed this many times. When I'm reading a work of imagination, whether a poem, a novel, or a short story, I identify with the author and with the characters, and I become thoroughly absorbed in them. I quite consciously and deliberately suspend my critical faculties at the time, and only afterwards do I allow them to come into play. It seems that I have a great capacity for empathy, and this extends not just to works of literature, but even to works of philosophy and religion. It's only afterwards that I apply my critical faculties. I think one has to imagine this, has to have this imaginative empathy first, before the critical faculties come into play. If one is really to appreciate a work of art and to evaluate it deeply, I think some of our greatest critics, such as Coleridge, have had that power of initial empathy. So this is Bante in the Conversations describing, I mean, he's in the context of the Conversations, he's just trying to elucidate some things about his character for people to be able to understand him better. But he's making, I think, a very valid point, which is this ability to empathetically engage with whatever he's reading whilst suspending his critical faculties. It's only later that he starts to think about things and think, you know, does this express right view? Do I agree with this? How does this compare with other things? Yeah, he just becomes absorbed by an empathetic, imaginative engagement with whatever he's reading first. In a way, I think that's something we, if we're going to engage in this hearing of the sutras, we need something of this quality. Bante's talking particularly about reading, but I think it applies equally to hearing sutras. Unfortunately, I think this is a kind of a skill that we've largely been educated out of. I think our wider education and our wider culture so highly emphasises and teaches us to use the critical faculty that a lot of people have lost the ability or don't quite believe fully in this ability to enter into a work imaginatively or empathetically. But in a way, that is what we're trying to do. But I think it's a skill we've got to kind of relearn quite a... I'm suggesting it's a skill we have to relearn. In a way, Ratnaguna was referring to this morning when he was talking about when you, as a child, you listen to a story. You do that without your critical faculty. You know, at that age, it's pre-critical faculty. You haven't developed a critical faculty. A child's just able to enter into a story in a much more direct way, which is probably similar to this imaginative, empathetic kind of reading that Bante's talking about. But it also came up in our group, and Antimani was asking how she could drop her more sort of rational, discursive mind and just be able to fully enter into the world of the text. And yeah, I think it is a skill and a learning and art that we can need to relearn. But I've got a few thoughts about the hearing wisdom. So last year we had a talk on the a retreat on the Vimalakirti Nidesha, and we read the whole of the sutra on that retreat. And I just gave a series of short little talks each evening before we heard something of the sutra. So I'm just going to share some of those thoughts with you. So we've got this notion of the hearing wisdom, and usually it's in a list, the threefold list, Shrutamaya Prajna, the hearing or listening wisdom, Chintamaya Prajna, the thinking or reflecting wisdom, and Bhavanamaya Prajna, the becoming or meditating wisdom. In a way, that does represent a sort of a sequence that we can quite naturally go through sometimes in our apprehension of the Dharma. The problem with lists, particularly hierarchical lists like that, is that they prejudice us against the lower levels of the list. often we want to go, oh, well, we want to develop the highest of these, and we overlook the significance or the importance of the earlier stages. However, Bante, in a talk he gave to open the Manchester Buddhist Centre in 96 or 97, something like that, he talked about these three levels of wisdom. Instead of putting them in this hierarchical ascending order, he just talked about them as three ways in which wisdom can arise. So it's the same wisdom, but it can arise through listening, through reflecting, or through meditating, embodying, becoming. Yeah. It's one of these ones where he takes a traditional teaching and kind of sees something quite different in it. I found it very illuminating that he's talked about them in these ways. And he gives a couple of examples in that talk, and subsequently there are famous examples of the hearing wisdom. I'm going to mention just three. One of them we'll all be familiar with is Bahia, the story of Bahia and the bark garment. So goes on this long pilgrimage across India to meet the Buddha, interrupts him on his arms round, is told now is not the time, and you know, keeps asking the Buddha for a teaching. And the Buddha turns to him and says, in the seen, only the seen, etc. We're probably all familiar with the story. Bahia realises the import of that teaching straight away. He doesn't go away and practice Chintamaya Prajna and Bhavnamaya Prajna. Wisdom arises in that instant. At least that's how we're given it in the story. Yeah. So we don't have to do the reflection and the meditating for wisdom to arise. It can come about through this just hearing of the Dharma. Yeah. Another very famous example is Hui Neng, from the Sutra of Hui Neng. Hui Neng's supposedly an illiterate youngish boy or young man, maybe. He's out looking for or buying a faggot of wood he's looking after his mother, and he's buying a faggot of wood to be able to cook for her and keep her warm. And he's just in the marketplace, and then he hears somebody reciting the Diamond Sutra in that marketplace. And again, he, as the description goes in his autobiography in the Sutra of Hui Neng, at that point he has an awakening. He then subsequently deepens that. He goes to find the fifth patriarch of Chan Buddhism and deepens that understanding. But he hears something of the import of the Diamond Sutra there and then. Again, so it's not mediated by reflection and meditating. He understands something straight away. And then the other example for us is Bante himself. You know, when he describes... this is from reading rather than hearing, but when he read the Diamond Sutra when he was 16, he clearly, from his own description, he grasped or understood something of the nature of that text. Interesting, it's the same text that Hui Neng also awoke to or had an awakening experience with. But again, not mediated by the thinking or the meditating. Hui Neng gives his own kind of account of why he thought that happened. He just explains it in traditional terms of he must have had good karma, and that's why he was able to awaken when hearing the Diamond Sutra. If you imagine, presumably most of the other people in the marketplace didn't have that experience. It's just him. So there's a coming together of certain conditions within him with the external conditions that lead to an awakening. Bante just talks about it as he... realised he was a Buddhist and as he always had been, in that slightly sort of enigmatic phrase. He doesn't reflect on why that might have happened in quite the same way. So anyway, those are examples of the hearing wisdom. It can actually be a direct way of understanding the import of the Buddha's teachings. Bante then develops his thinking in... that talk from the Manchester Buddhist Centre in another talk he gave called In Standing on Holy Ground, which is a few years later. And in that he goes on to equate the three levels of wisdom with the three primary character types from Buddhist tradition. So he equates the meditating wisdom with the body witness, He equates the reflecting wisdom with the doctrine follower or the wisdom type, and he equates the hearing wisdom with the faith type. Quite interesting that he makes that connection of hearing the Dharma with faith. Yeah. So there's something in that, you know, if we're going to have an experience of the hearing wisdom, something really happening, we need to bring something of faith to it. But also, and this is certainly my experience, hearing the Dharma is also can bring about the experience of faith. It's through coming in contact with the Dharma that faith awakens. I think it's a kind of reciprocal relationship. But there is there's an interesting connection with the Pure Land tradition, certainly in later Pure Land tradition, where the Nembutsu, the hearing or the reciting of the name of Amida, Nyan Tian Fo in Chinese or Namu Amida Butsu in Japanese, that becomes, and certainly in certain parts of Pure Land tradition, it becomes the principal way of coming in contact with Amida. So it's not a visualizing tradition, it's a hearing tradition. There's this connection between, you know, sort of a faith-based Buddhism and hearing. Interestingly enough, in Shin Buddhism is the, I'm describing the tradition of Pure Land Buddhism that comes from Shinran. It's a particular development within Pure Land, and it doesn't apply to the whole Pure Land tradition. But in Shin Buddhism, you have this term Monpo. Well, Mon is hearing, Monpo is deep hearing. And this is how one comes into relationship with Amida's primal vow. This is how it's described. So Amida's primal vow is the, put in other words, is the sort of compassionate activity of enlightenment reaching out to us deluded beings. So yes, they. Why would the hearing wisdom be associated with faith? I think there's something about hearing where it is, you might say, it's more of a receptive sense. With our seeing, with our eyes, we have more conscious control over what we do with our eyes than we do with our ears. You know, we can turn to look at something, we direct our gaze more fully. I think it's more closely associated with our sense of self as well, you might say, though you can talk about that if you want to ask questions about that. With hearing, we just hear whatever is around. You can do that, you can try to hear a bit more clearly, but it's a more open, receptive sense. So there's something about hearing and receptivity, and that's what Monpo is about. This deep hearing of the name of Amida is a receptivity to Amida's compassionate influence, at least in Shin tradition. It's also, they talk about it, it's not just an ordinary auditory sensation, but it's a matter of the whole person. Deep hearing of the Dharma means embodying the Buddha Dharma, an experiential awakening of the total self, conscious and unconscious, mind and body. So they're talking about hearing as something in a way more profound than just the literal vibrations going on in my mouth to your ear and your ear to your brain, and you know, it's more than that. It's a sort of a deep hearing, a deep listening to something, attuning oneself to something. I did, in the talks I gave on the Vimalakirti Nidesha retreat, I did make my own little equation. You know, we have these five eyes from Buddhist tradition. You have the physical eye, the divine eye, the wisdom eye, the Dharma eye, the wisdom eye, and the Buddha eye. I think you can come up with a similar kind of list for hearing. There's the ordinary ear through which we're hearing each other now. The divine ear, which would be clairaudience. You know, this is one of the traditional abhinyas, powers that comes in meditation. You might also say, you know, there's this famous example given of Mozart hearing his symphonies in one and then writing them out. Maybe this is the kind of ear that Mozart was hearing the music that he subsequently wrote out. I mean, I had I'll just give one example. When I was on my ordination course at Gukyiloka in 1992, I had a number of dreams, but one of them, it's one of the most striking dreams I've had in my life. I was at an order gathering. It's quite a simple dream. It's just a sort of an image and a moment rather than a sequence. And I was just wandering around this order gathering, actually with tears streaming down my face, and I was hearing this music like I'd never heard before. I mean, it really felt like it was something of the choir of angels. And I mean, when I woke up, I thought that it was a piece of music that I knew, but it wasn't like that at all. And in a way, I've never quite heard music like that. It was a music that I was hearing in a different kind of way. You know, I mean, that's obviously what can sometimes happen in an archetypal dream. So you've got that would be the divine ear. Then you've got what you could perhaps call the Dharma ear, which is what perhaps Bahia and Hui Neng heard their teachings with. They were just able to hear and realise the truth of what they were hearing at that particular time. Then we could have the wisdom ear. So I was equating this with the Pure Land tradition, when we hear the birds and the trees and the rivers communicating the sound of impermanence to us. It's not through literal translation into words and concepts. It's not like we hear the birds singing impermanence, impermanence, impermanence. It's something much subtler than that. But we hear it as an evocation of impermanence, yeah? But it's also a beautiful form, as Ratnaguna said this morning. And then the Buddha ear, you might say, is when we hear with no separation of self and other at all. It's a non-dualistic hearing where there's no sort of imposition of this is me hearing that at all. There's just a sort of direct perception. So there are a couple of other things. These, in a way, they're just a series of reflections rather than a full sort of sequence. In Buddhist tradition, there's a term called Dharma Parayaya. It comes partly in the White Lotus Sutra, certainly comes from Mahayana tradition. Parayaya. And Bante, I'm just going to read you, it's a longish quote. I'll hopefully then make sense of it to you afterwards. In exploring, he's actually exploring the example from the Sutra of Hui Neng, where Hui Neng has this awakening experience in the marketplace, listening to the Diamond Sutra. So this is from the seminar on the Sutra of Hui Neng, and it's sort of arising out of that point in the sutra. So Bhante says, there's a Sanskrit word, parayaya, which literally means turning over or revolving. It's got a double meaning. It means reciting in the sense of reciting out loud, and it also means revolving in the mind. Turning over in the mind in such a way that you penetrate to the spiritual import. So this is the sort of recitation that the fifth patriarch would have encouraged. Not only repeating the words of the scripture, but revolving in your own mind as well. Dwelling upon it, meditating upon it. You could even learn it by heart. Then repeat the words of the text to yourself in a quiet sort of meditative way and make them the basis of, as it were, contemplation in a meditative mood. Then, of course, you could dwell upon the inner meaning, eventually independent of the actual words of the text. And this would be really sort of revolving the text and really penetrating into the sutra. This is what Buddhist tradition has in mind when it speaks in terms of recitation. Though, of course, often this was misunderstood and people just recited, as we shall see later on. But what it actually means is that through the personal recitation of the text, which you've learned by heart, or even a mindful reading of it, and then, as it were, pondering upon the meaning of the words, and finally getting through to the inner essence, you come to a sort of understanding or insight, even experience, which gradually becomes dissociated from the words, and on which you can dwell, and which you can increase and intensify, and in this way come to a closer contact with the innermost essence of the text, or what the text represents or says. This is what pariaya really is. Just as in the visualization exercises, by visualizing you gradually build up a certain feeling, a certain experience, and then you can, as it were, stop visualizing and remain with that feeling or with that experience. You go from form, as it were, to formlessness. It's much the same with the pariaya, but it's there from words to wordlessness, from the meaning as conveyed by words to the meaning as not conveyed by words. I was very struck when I read this. It actually, I think, needs quite a lot of teasing out, as basically describing this recitation of Dharma texts as a profound spiritual practice. Yeah, in the way that sadhana becomes a profound spiritual practice, this move from form to formlessness, where you sort of recreate the experience in your own consciousness of what you're reciting, yeah? Or just coming out of this term, pariaya. So recitation, yeah, he makes the point that, it was misunderstood and later on people just came to recite. So this is presumably the mouth recitation, what we can sometimes do, unfortunately, perhaps when we're reciting the Heart Sutra and the Sevenfold Puja, you know, we just say it and we've lost the sort of sense of meaningful connection with it. It's become a bit of a habitual repetition. But this is trying to describe something else where we're really trying to enter into the import of the text to the point where we get to something beyond the words of the text itself, to the import, the meaning of the text. Yeah. And then I'm going to say, draw in something from another tradition. This is just little sort of suggestions for how we might approach the practice of hearing the Dharma. There's a practice in Christianity called Lectio Divina, divine reading. Goes back to Saint Benedict, but as it's formulated, it comes from a character called Guigo, a 12th century Carthusian from Grand Chartreuse. And it outlines four stages of hearing. Obviously, in this context, it's hearing the Bible, hearing the Word of God. So this is how they engage with it. But I think there's something in it that we could learn from. Particularly, it's trying to inculcate a kind of listening where you're not seeking information or even motivation either. You know, so these are two of the things that we can engage with Dharma texts for. We can engage with them for information, you know, about ethical practices, about how to meditate, you know, as it were, particular advice on that. Or we can encounter the Dharma, you know, read the Dharma for inspiration, for motivation. But in this context, they're talking about it as something in you're reading the Dharma, reading the Bible in this context for communion, so that you actually come into a deep communion with the Word of God. And it's a full stage process. So it starts with lectio, which is the word for reading, but this is meant where somebody reads and other monks would be listening. So it is something you would hear. So they talk about this. You prepare by becoming still and quiet. Then you have a slow and gradual reading of the scriptural passage, perhaps several times. So that's the first stage that they talk about. Second stage is meditatio, meditation. But this, they describe this as pondering, meaning to weigh or consider something. But you ponder the passage without immediately seeking a meaning. Yeah. So I think this is the bit where we're not responding to it through the rational mind. We're not looking for a rational intellectual content or meaning. So you, and they talk about it as waiting and staying open to the possibility of new meaning. So rather than thinking that you have grasped a meaning or you know the meaning, you wait and stay open to the possibility of something else emerging. Yeah. think it's a very good description of how we can hear. The third of the four stages is oratio, which they translate as pray. So this is a loving and open-hearted receptivity, inviting the descent of a higher understanding. It's a lovely way of putting it. So basically this is acknowledging that we're not going to exhaust the meaning of a text by rationally, intellectually apprehending it. We need, if we're to fully awaken to it or understand it, something else has to come in. Whether we call this, you know, an imaginal perception, as Ratnaguna was doing this morning, or describe it in some other way, it's being aware of the fact that, yeah, if we're just relating to it from our current level of consciousness, and particularly through a sort of an intellectual or rational understanding, well, we'll limit what we're going to get from that text. So we actually pray, in a way, entreaty and supplication is an example of this from the Sevenfold Puja, a loving and open-hearted receptivity inviting the descent of a higher understanding. It's interesting, I reread something of Bhante's in the Bodhisattva Ideal series. He talks about praying in the context of exploring Kshanti. And he particularly talks about praying as a spirit, as a sort of a practice of spiritual receptivity. So in praying for something, you're definitely acknowledging that you don't have something. You're imploring or praying or, you know, asking for something that you don't have. So it implies that state of significant openness, spiritual receptivity, an awareness that you don't, in your current level of consciousness, you don't have an answer, you don't have the understanding. Yeah. So then, having been through these three stages, the lectio, the reading or hearing, the meditatio, the pondering without immediately seeking a meaning, then the praying, you arrive at a state of contemplatio, in the Latin, contemplation, which they describe as a silent, wordless union with the meaning of the text, given through grace, so it doesn't arise through your own power. It arises as something separate from that. I mean, perhaps if we were to, I'm just thinking about the way they describe samayasattva and jnanasattva in visualization practice. So samayasattva is the form of the deity that we ourselves create with our, well, not just with a rational mind, but with our ordinary unenlightened consciousness, as it were. And then at some point, the jnanasattva descends. That's the, as they talk about it in sadhana, that's the eruption into our consciousness of something genuinely other. So this silent, wordless union with the meaning of the text given through grace, it's something that arises not through our ordinary ways of perceiving things. So again, it was a very stimulating talk you gave this morning, Ratnaguna, but that was one of the things when you were talking about insight and illumination. You know, that this we've got this kind of very rationalistic, sense-based idea of the human mind, I think, very prevalent in our wider culture. But it's interesting, this goes back, this Lectio Divina, it goes back to the more sort of traditional, pre-modern Western understanding of the nature of the mind and of intellect. You know, intellect in those days would have meant more by what we mean as imagination now, I think. But yeah, if we just approach a text like the Sukhavati Viewer Sutras that we're reading from that largely sort of rational or materialistic perspective, that's what we'll end up seeing in it, and it probably won't hold our attention that long. But this is sort of trying to say that in coming into relationship to a text like the Sukhavati Viewer Sutras, it does purport to be an account of reality, or at least an aspect of reality. It's Buddha Vachana. It's the word of the Buddha trying to communicate to us something of his enlightened perspective. So when we're coming into relationship with that, if we just, we're trying not to reduce it to our current state of consciousness, we're trying to open up into the state of consciousness that is being evoked or communicated through the Buddha Vajrayana through the communication of the enlightened mind, in this case in the Sukhavati Sutras. I'll just one other thing that I'll just say I think is very important. It's a similar topic. Is partly just talking about this, but it's the one Bhante's been saying a lot about. Bhante and Subhuti in recent years. This quality of garva, of reverence. I think this is very important when we listen to the Dharma, that we come to it with an attitude of reverence. So there's the Garva Sutta. But it's interesting in that latest piece of writing, one of Bhante's latest pieces of writing, so he talks about the Garva, you know, in the Garva Sutta, the Buddha's talking about, or he's showing us a way to live. We should be living with reverence. So the Buddha is revering something beyond himself, not literally the words of the Dharma in this case. But if we don't come to a reading of the sutra with that attitude of reverence, well, again, we're not going to be open to its full import and meaning. Garva literally comes from the root guru, which means weighty, amongst other things, weighty, important, significant. So when we're coming to hear the sutra, we're coming to hear something that is very weighty, very important, and you know that will allow us to open up to it more. We need that quality of garva when we're hearing the Dharma more fully.